Loving Father, once again on this Holy Sabbath, we come before You asking that Your Spirit might remain with us, that our minds might be alert this afternoon, that we might not only understand what You would have spoken, but also to know how to incorporate it within our lives so that we might see changes come about that can really hasten the day of Jesus' return. Bless us now as we spend this hour together, and help us that we might be very grateful that we've come and that we've taken the time to listen and to share. In Jesus' name, amen. This afternoon, we are going to show a few things on the overhead, a couple of things. First of all, I'd like to just draw your attention to a couple of little items. One thing that I wanted to share with you was one thing I wanted to share with you on the overhead this afternoon is this little line right here. You see that little green line? Kids like the little finger on there, right? That little green line is the physical growth of the church. Notice by 1910, way over here, actually it's about 1910 is what we're talking about. Let me just share with you what was happening within the Adventist church by 1910 as far as spiritual growth went. In 1910, the year that isn't really on here, but it should be, it's right where that dot is, okay? 1910, in that year we had $1 million in book sales in that 1 year alone. That was a fantastic sales for 1 year for our Cole Porter ministers. We had 196 missionaries sent out in that same year. We had 3,400 baptized in that year. And folks, what we're talking about is about 90,000 people, which you'll have to look over on this side. When we run it right across there to that little dot, we had about 90,000 Seventh-day Adventists. Now think of that, 90,000 Seventh-day Adventists and yet $1 million worth of sales, 4,300 baptized, and by that time in 1910 we had a total of 700 schools, and we're going to talk about our schools this afternoon. 700 of them and 21,000 students by the end of 1910. And you'll notice what happened, if you can see it there on the chart, which you can. 1910, that thing just went almost straight out of sight from then on. Physical growth was incredible within the Adventist church. But the thing that I've tried to share with you today is that the thing that is even more important to God is our spiritual growth. And as we took a look today, and I'm not going to go back over those dates, I normally have a handout here, but each one of these special little dates along here, if you had your crayons out today and were marking those dates down, these are the dates you were reading. And you can see spiritually until we finally fell into apostasy and right on down, down, down spiritually. And it's so interesting on the graph because we see the physical growth going almost in the opposite direction of our spiritual growth. So I come to a statement that Ellen made once, and I think you can find that in one of the early testimonies, where she said, if numbers was an indication of success, Satan might claim the preeminence, for in this world, his numbers are largely in the majority. So if we're impressed with numbers, folks, so is Satan. But Jesus said, I'm not after numbers, I'm after quality. He said it's the religious piety, the righteousness, the character development in his people that he's concerned about. He's not concerned just with their numbers. My friend Dave that I ate dinner with today shared with me a comment that I had made some time ago, and that was that God wouldn't be impressed if the whole world became Seventh-day Adventists. Why would he remind me of a statement like that? That sounds heretical. And I said, Dave, we shouldn't preach that around. He said, well, you said it. And I remember I did say that. And then I said, you remember what I said after that? Yes. God isn't wanting the whole world to be lukewarm. That's why God would not be impressed if the whole world became Adventist. If Adventists are in apostasy, and if Adventists are lukewarm, and if Adventists are fighting each other, what value would it be to God if the whole world became fighting, lukewarm, so-called Christians? Wouldn't do any good. So that's why God, may I suggest something this afternoon? I believe that God is holding the people out there in ignorance until His church is ready. And when we are ready, then He will unstop their eyes and unplug their ears, and they will see that we are God's chosen people. But see, God doesn't want to spoil it for them prematurely. He wants them to see how great this church really is. Isn't that exciting? And I'm so glad that He doesn't want to expose us before the world right now. And right now He's covering us, folks, and I thank God for that. I really do. Adventism is still the best-kept secret of the century. And I thank God for that. And I'm reminded of another statement. The reason that God does not now work to bring others within the church is because of those who have backslidden and those who have never been converted. It tells me that in a sense, God is not just opening up the doors to let thousands come into the church. Why? Because He loves them too much at this point. Because many who would come in wouldn't be the quality that could hang in here seeing all the problems that are going on. Do you understand what I'm saying? So God loves them too much. That doesn't mean that He's angry with us. God isn't angry with us. He's just letting us do our own thing. He loves us so much, He's letting us do our own thing. And right now we're wandering in the wilderness, and He simply is plugging the ears, closing the eyes of the people of the world, winking in their time of ignorance, and many of them will be saved. Never heard of Adventism. But my, oh my, what a difference it could have been had they understood the message that you and I are privileged to understand. What frustration it could have lifted off of their hearts and minds. What joy and peace they could have had they known what you and I are privileged to have. And yet God will probably save scores of them anyway. Follow what I'm saying? So He loves them, and I thank God for the statement of great controversy that not one soul who honestly desires at whatever cost to know the truth will be lost. Isn't that a good news? Not one soul who honestly desires at whatever cost will be lost. So God's going to save everybody who wants to go. I like that. And if you want to go, folks, then there's no reason why you can't, because the decision is up to you and to me. Now, having shared that little bit and a little introduction, we need to get into some things this afternoon because we have a lot of territory to cover and some very important things. One of the things I'm going to share today, I've never shared before on tape that I'm aware of. I don't think I have. And it's very important material as we take a look again at some history. But our subject this afternoon in our third part is our future is in our hands. If God doesn't come, we can't blame Him. Our future is in our hands. It's so easy for us to blame the Israelites for not going into the promised land. And yet, how many years have we wandered in the wilderness? It's so easy to blame Adam and Eve at the garden and at the tree. And yet, how many times have we plucked fruit that we should have never touched? We're all the same, aren't we, folks? We've all made mistakes. So we're not here to sling mud, but we are here to take a look at where we've been, where we are, and by God's grace, where we can be if we choose. So the future is truly in our hands. Let's go back to the year 1915. Ellen died, and her testimonies came to a close. We left off today, the 11 o'clock service, with her laying down her pen, with a final warning that we must not seek the ways of the world. And yet we were at a crossroads just before she died. Brethren, we don't need a higher education than what God Himself has given us. And by higher education, I'm simply meaning the higher criticism and the philosophy of the world. Okay? By 1915, after she died, the writers of the Advent Review and Sabbath Herald continued to write. And I'd like to just hit a few key titles of the main articles that were being written between the years 1925 and 1944, just before I was born. Some of you were living during these years. Some of you may even recall having read some of these articles. May bring back some old memories. So that won't hurt us to go back and refresh our memory. But I want you to notice something. I'm not going to bother to take excerpts from the articles. I just want to read the title of the article. Because in so doing, over a period of years, you can suddenly see a trend beginning to take place. And it's so obvious that it's incredible. The same thing if you wrote down those little dates today and then listened to what was being said, you could see a direct chain of apostasy developing until finally she said, "We are now in apostasy." And you could see it coming. And so, as I read these, you'll see a chain of events begin to transpire. Notice, as Ellen gave us the advice to stay away and untainted from the world, notice the big question now after she's dead. In August 18, 1928, The big question and the big issue in the review was attending the university. The big question, should we or should we not? 1928. That same year, another article called Shall Our Schools Come Up Higher? What did we mean by higher? What did we mean, folks? Look at my hands. What did we mean by higher? Into a higher sphere of intelligentsia? What did they mean? By 1928, January of that same year, another article was, Will Our Schools Hold Steady? Shall We Maintain Our Separation from the Schools? 1929, the following year. 1930, next year, Perils in Worldly Education. That same year, The Quality of Our Schools. 1931, Would Christ Be Acceptable as a Bible Teacher in Our Modern Schools? Please note that question. We'll come back to it in a bit. 1932, The Passing of the Church College. 1932, the last part of that year, Why an Accredited College? 1937, University Degrees. 1940, In the Educational World. 1940, Worldly Education. That was a three-part series. 1942, The Crisis in Education. 1944, Starvation by Philosophy. That same year, Alarming Trends in the Educational World and the Changed Character of Christian Colleges. Isn't that phenomenal when you read that? From the question, should we attend the universities, what are they? Is it all right to come up a little higher and accept maybe some higher standards for education than what God was privileged to give us? And in a course of years, from 1926 to 1944, we went from the question of attending the university to alarming trends in the educational world and the changed character of Christian colleges. Now that kind of was exciting when I first read that, and I said, could it be that we haven't really come back since Ellen died? Could it be that that little if that she said, that our schools are still prisoners of hope if we heed the counsel that God has given? But beloved, as I go back and take a look at history, which we're told to do, and I apply it and take a look at where we've been, I notice we did not heed the counsel. Had we heeded the counsel, we would not have continued to go into the direction that I find we have, or had, by 1944. Now, since 1944, I've discovered also, in more current history, my history, that we still haven't changed nor come back to God's ideal. In fact, we have continued to go more and more into the worldly mindset. I don't say that condemningly, okay? I say it as a matter of fact, because that is reality. And until we can take a look at where we really are, we'll never see any need for changing. I'd like for you to note the interesting change in our position concerning qualified teachers in our colleges during the same time. Remember, we didn't have very many fellows in our church when we first started that had degrees. We had some very common people, but they were students of God's Word. They were of the idiotes caliber. But they had been recognized as having been with Jesus. These were the pioneers of Adventism, students of the Word of God, and God blessed them. But now what happens over the course of years when these men who were not learned, not educated, were beginning to pass off the scene, and new men came on, what was the course of our direction? I'm reading from Advent Review of December 18, 1930. A question is asked by a concerned layman. I find that an interesting term because that was actually what they used in the Review and Herald. And this is the question the layman asks. Would we permit Christ to head up a theological department in one of our colleges? Have you ever wondered that? Here is the editor's response, and I quote from the Review. In answer to the question, the editor sincerely believes that our schools would welcome the great master teacher, even though he came without worldly recognition or high scholastic attainment from worldly schools. We cannot but believe that this brother's fears were unfounded. And yet it is proper for us to think of the future. That's the future beyond 1930, folks. it's proper for us to think of the future and to raise the question as to whether we will indeed continue to welcome Christ and His humble representatives as one of the instructors in our educational institutions. End quote. Now, I thank God for editors such as that, that were willing to probe serious questions, just like we've been doing this weekend. This editor said, even though I don't think it would happen, he said, we need to seriously take a look at where we're going and what the future might bring as a result of the direction that we're headed presently. I appreciate editors that are open and willing to take a look at it. Notice again, he says, we think, same editor, of some of the staunch leaders of this movement, James White, Jay and Andrew, Uriah Smith, humble men like the apostles and yet possessing no high scholastic qualification. We named Andrews University, our theological seminary, after Jay and Andrew. But he was not a real educated man. He was a self-educated man. Shall we be forced, he writes, to reach a place in affiliation with worldly standards where such men will be denied the privilege of instructing our youth in the ways of God? This is no sentimental appeal. It is a simple, practical consideration of possibilities, but we believe not of probabilities, end quote. Now, what did he just say in our language? He's saying that it might happen. It's remotely possible that it could happen, but we believe that is highly unlikely that it ever really would. Something we need to consider, but folks, surely, surely that would never happen. 10 years later, January 25, 1940, in an edition of the Review and Herald of that year, a new editor now makes this observation. And I quote, Jesus carried no scholastic title. Sad to say, were Christ on earth today, he could not qualify as a Bible teacher because he would lack academic recognition. It would be said of him as of old, how knoweth this man letters, having never learned. See, we have nothing to fear for the future except as we what? Forget the direction that this church has been going for many, many years. And when we forget our past, we have a tendency, believe it or not, to repeat the past. Unless we realize what we're doing and change the cycle. How in the world could this happen? Let's go back and review our history for a moment. How could the Seventh-day Adventist Church reach a point where we would even deny the Lord Jesus Christ a position as the head of a theological department in one of our colleges? How could that ever happen in 1940? You see, folks, our educational system was well into apostasy, to the point we even denied Jesus Christ. We would have denied Jesus Christ the right to head up one of our departments in our own theology of our own college before I was born. I was born into a church that had been taken captive by the philosophy of the world. And yet I love this church. There's one reason why I won't leave it is because I refuse to allow Satan to put somebody else in my spot. And as long as I live and you live and we stand for what we believe to be fundamental Adventist principles and truth, Satan will never have full possession of this church. That's why, beloved, we dare not leave, because Satan would love for us to walk out of this church because we become discouraged at what we see, and then immediately he'll fill our spot with one of his men. Who knows but what Satan is waiting even now for a few more standard bearers to walk away so that he can take their place. It's kind of a rough paraphrase of my favorite author. Satan is just waiting to create more friction, more stress, more problems in the church so that he can take our place. And I refuse to let him have my place. How about you? You encourage me this afternoon. You encourage me. You make me want to keep preaching. Let's go back and take a look at some history. Again, the question, how could this have actually happened? Let's take a look and see. Because remember, an enemy has done this. And folks, he's been doing it to us. We too have been deceived, just like those before. So let's not cast any blame, okay? Let's just pick up the responsibility, what do you say, where we are, and let's do something about it. According to the Great Controversy, page 289, The English reformers were renouncing the doctrines of Rome, while renouncing the doctrines of Romanism, had retained many of its forms. Now that's an important point that we understand. Here Ellen is sharing with us some history about what was taking place with the English reformers. She said, while they renounced the doctrine of Romanism, they still retained many of its forms. Folks, you cannot hold on to the world and Christ at the same time. You can't have it both ways. It's either one or. And if you accept any part of the world, you ultimately accept the whole world. Because it comes part and parcel. Eventually, you'll let go more and more of God, and until you look like a Christian, or you may think you look like a Christian, but you've actually converted yourself into a servant on the other side. Folks, it can happen. It can happen. As a classic example, history shows that while the English reformers broke away from the doctrines of the papacy, they ignorantly adopted the entire form of papal education. They thought that by sandwiching in a little Bible and flavoring their teaching with some religious instruction, they would have Christian education. Who was this? This was the English reformers, long before anybody ever heard of a Seventh-day Adventist. They thought that they could have, they could not have been farther from the truth. But they thought they were upholding the truth. For in time, the whole Protestant system began to resemble, guess who? The papacy. You see, Ellen wrote us a little law in Great Controversy 555, an easy one to remember. It is a law of the mind that by beholding, we gradually become changed into the likeness of that which we behold. That's my paraphrase, but it says basically that same thing. When I look at Ninja Turtles long enough, I begin to act like a Ninja Turtle. I take on the characteristics of those little guys, or whatever else happens to be the fad at the time, okay? There are new ones that replace the turtles and so on, but all I'm saying is, what we behold, we become like. And when we are taking on the form of the papal educational teaching, then we ultimately take on the characteristics of it. And before long, by looking at us, you couldn't tell the difference between us and Rome. And God said, I want you to be separate. I don't want you to touch the unclean thing. I want you to come totally out. But you know, folks, we're no different than Israel. Because when Israel came out of Egypt, they brought a lot of Egypt with them. Did you notice that? And we as Seventh-day Adventists in 1844, after the passing of the time, brought a lot of Methodism with us, Presbyterianism with us. We patterned our whole Sabbath school structure after the Methodist Church. And we better never change that, even though the great church of Methodists supposedly fell after 1844. Early writing seems to indicate that. But yet we kept the methods. I'm not harping on that. All I'm saying, we just have to grow from where we are. And we take where we are and move from there. That's all the early pioneers did. They had to have something, so why not bring in the structure, the last thing they knew, and they carried on some of that structure. But it wasn't enough. Notice what happens. Even though the English reformers tried for years to stop their slide into apostasy, they failed to realize that it was a direct result of their philosophy of education, which had been borrowed from Rome. As a result of mixing the papacy system of education with their own, the English reformers were morally ruined and cast aside. Satan had won again. Only one body stood between him and total victory. That was the remnant. The last of the woman's seed. Could Satan deceive, if possible, even the very elect? This last chosen race? The elect of God? After all, he had been successful in the overthrow of the Jewish church and the apostolic church. He had neutralized the 16th century Reformation through the infiltration of the Jesuits. And now he had successfully thwarted the efforts of the English reformers who had attempted to establish a foothold on the shores of this nation of America to destroy Satan's power once and for all. But would he be able to win again against this new Advent movement? The early Advent people realized when the passing of the time came that the churches around them and the schools around them had become so corrupt that they had been called Babylon. Do you remember that? We even used one of the angels of Revelation 14 to prove that Babylon has fallen. The first and second angels' message were being preached shortly after 1844. Seventh-day Adventist, or the Advent movement, came out of that fallen condition, out of fallen Babylon, and we then were the remnant. We were the chosen. We didn't want to touch that anymore. So we were crying, Babylon has fallen. And yet, in spite of that, the early Advent people left these Protestant congregations just like the English reformers left the European papal system decades before. What do I mean they left the same way? I mean that the faithful remnant separated themselves from the papal doctrines of the Protestant churches, but like the English reformers, they too ignorantly carried into their own educational system the spirit and forms of the papal power. And thus Ellen wrote a caution many times through her writings about education. Why was she so concerned about education? May I share with you why I believe she was so concerned? She was concerned because she knew that the generations that were taught by the adult teachers would espouse the teachings of what they were being instructed. And if the teachers could be corrupted by bringing into their educational system the philosophy of the world, then the next generation of children would buy into what they were being taught. Therefore, they would accept it as truth. And it would have the appearance of being fundamental Seventh-day Adventist teaching. But yet it still had some attachments to worldly philosophy and psychology. And as a result, we continued to fall down in our education. Until finally Ellen appealed to us before her death that our brethren are being tested over this area of education. She was deeply concerned. We needed youth who would be rightly trained, not taught the wrong message. Now you might ask, well, where in the world, where did all this education come from? Certainly, it couldn't have been all bad that we adopted. Let me show you how bad it really was. May I? Let's go back again and take a look at the very beginning of our educational foundation. The one that we accepted, just like those before us. They extended their hands toward the forbidden tree and plucked the fruit that they should have never touched. At first, our sin, like theirs, didn't seem to be so great, for we had only borrowed from the religious colleges of the Protestant denominations around us, just like they had borrowed from somebody before them. But some of us evidently were not wise enough to go back and follow the root of the fruit. And folks, if the root is corrupted, then all of the fruit is corrupted. Are you with me? That's why Jesus said a good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit. And folks, if we have evil fruit today, it's because something is wrong somewhere. And maybe we need to go clear back to the root and cut that root off and separate ourselves from that unclean thing. Now, that may hurt, may be embarrassing, and it may cost us something to do it. But it's imperative that some generation stop the cycle. Our sin, again, didn't seem to be so great as we compared with others around us. However, we must have forgotten that they out there had fallen and were not in a position to show us the way in Christian education. We were preaching that Babylon has fallen, and yet we use some of their very techniques to train our children in. Now, we wouldn't do that today, would we? See, we can look at these people, and they were truly ignorant. But today, certainly, we've learned from their mistakes, and we wouldn't repeat that, would we? I almost say that tongue-in-cheek, folks, and it's a serious thing. It really isn't. It isn't funny. It's a serious thing. But as I look at this, it almost is humorous how we can pick these cycles up and just carry them on and think we're doing the will of God. Had we only remembered the source of their polluted fountain, we probably would never have drunk from their toxic cup. The roots of the forbidden tree that produced the deadly fruit so far back in history, but is there for those who desire to see it. And in 8 simple steps, this is the way it was. I'm sorry this isn't on the overhead for you. Don't bother to write it down. Just listen to it. Let's go back and see where our education root was. Our educational plan that we devised shortly after the passing of the time when we got together and started our own Christian educational institutions in our little home schools and then branched out into our first education. By 1910, we had 700 of these institutions running around. Listen how it started. Our educational plan was borrowed from the religious colleges of the Protestant denominations, which had already fallen. But we didn't have any other curriculum to borrow from other than what we had. So we reached out and hoped we wouldn't be contaminated. But where had they gotten theirs from? Secondly, those denominations had received their light from the older institutions of our country, such as Harvard and Yale. Well, where did Harvard and Yale get theirs? Harvard and Yale borrowed theirs from Oxford and Cambridge. Well, where did Oxford and Cambridge get theirs? Well, they were the daughters of Paris University. Who was Paris University? Paris University was presided over by the papists and was holy papal, being under the mother of European universities. Oh, the root gets deeper, doesn't it? You see what we borrowed from the Protestants? Catholicism. But we didn't see it as Catholicism because Protestantism had broken away from Catholicism, so certainly to borrow from Protestantism isn't. But it was. It gets deeper. Where did Paris University get her material? Well, she borrowed her educational system from pagan Rome. Where did pagan Rome get hers? She gathered into her arms the elements of Grecian and Oriental culture. Grecian, Greece. And where did that come from? The Grecian schools drew their wisdom and inspiration from ancient Egypt. Oh, now I see, Ellen, what you meant when we were headed toward Egypt. Oh, but how would she know? Only a third grader. Having never gone through our schools. You know, folks, I can almost thank God she didn't. I thank God she had a higher instructor that showed her the root so that she could identify the present fruit and say we must come back to God's ideal, which is higher than the highest human thought can reach. And we're substituting God's ideal for that which is fallen and corrupt and polluted and self-centered and egocentric and will destroy. It will never heal. Ellen pled with this church. We're still prisoners. What do you mean prisoners? We were prisoners of hope if history tells me we didn't heed the if. And as a result, I predict that one day, unless some generation breaks the cycle, I predict on what Ellen wrote, that every school among us will be closed up. And not because the world closed them, but because we closed them. Because we've lost the vision of Christian education. Because our education is no more than a religious course tucked in, sandwiched in, among all of the other academia that were required by law to teach. I'm being frank with you today, folks. I hope you don't mind that. I want to be honest with you. We have some serious problems. And I thank God for men today in the Adventist Church that are facing some of these serious problems and are seriously looking at what can we do to stop the cycle. They're asking the same questions that I'm asking this afternoon. And I thank God for men in this church that are beginning to wrestle with the very issues that I'm presenting to you today. They need your help and your cooperation. Let me read on one other little statement. The Grecian schools drew their wisdom and inspiration from ancient Egypt. The Greeks in ancient times were accustomed to borrow their politics and their learning from the Egyptians, and they looked upon Egypt as a school of wisdom. Greece sent thither her illustrious philosophers and lawgivers, such as Plato. Just thought you'd appreciate that. To complete their studies. Plato was the man that came up with this great philosophical understanding of higher sphere and lower sphere. He didn't do us any good. He got his training from Egypt. And that division that was inspired within his mind, you better put that inspiration in quotes, inspired within Plato's mind right out of ancient Egypt, infiltrated every school of thought clear down to our day. That there's a higher sphere and a lower sphere. And beloved, we bought into the system. And today, if you want to be a minister in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, you have to go through a ministerial course. Are you aware of that? That in order to be recognized as a member of the higher sphere, in order to be a kleros, a clergy person, you have to go through 4 years of college. And generally, I think it is now, you have to have at least a year's intern out in the field. They try to get them in to at least a year before they go back to Andrews, the seminary, for another 2 years to work on their Master of Divinity. After they do that, they come back into the field for another 2 to 3 years, some up to 5 years, before they receive the ordination for the gospel ministry. You can add up all those years if you want, but it becomes very discouraging to young men who would like to have a short course of study and get out and do the work that God's called them to do. Now, when I take a look at that, I say, something is wrong, because if you want to be a minister, you have to go through a certain system in order to arrive at that position. Well, what about just somebody that wants to take body and fender work, an automotive mechanic, and become a certified mechanic or an electrician? What if they want to go out and work with their hands? Is there a place of ministry for them? No. If you want to be a minister, you have to specialize. You get your bachelor's, then your master's, and you can work on your doctor of divinity. But you cannot be a minister of the lower sphere. This can't happen. Where does this come from? Got to share with you, folks, because that's where we're headed now. This was Plato's mentality that he borrowed from Egypt, because the pharaohs were worshipped as a god up here and all the other people were slaves down here. And Plato got the same philosophy, put a little religion in it, and he's divided, and Satan's philosophy has divided every generation from that day to this. And we too, ignorantly, bought into it. Now let's share some things with you and just see what Ellen had to say, and see if you understand now a little better some of these statements that she was making. The first one I'm reading is from Volume 7 of the Testimonies, 144. Written in 1902, you can see why now she said, perhaps, in choosing men and women for His service, God does not ask whether they possess learning or eloquence or worldly wealth. He asks, do they walk in such humility that I can teach them my way. What's God after? Obviously not the higher education. He's after humility of heart. Can I teach them? No, since 1940, God isn't even welcome to teach in one of our departments. What God is saying, can I teach? And we're saying, no, because we have a better way. What's your way? It's Egypt's way. God says, come out of Egypt. Learn not the way of the heathen. Be separate. Ellen still kept writing. Praise God for Ellen. Because folks, she was struggling against some of the very issues we're talking about. She had constant opposition. Are you aware of that? I know she did, because my uncle, my great uncle, gave her opposition. He was the president of all of California when Ellen was inspired by God to purchase Loma Linda, the place where the great university is today. My uncle was the president, and he smote his knees one against the other when she said, buy it. Ellen, that couldn't be a vision from God, because we don't have the money to buy it. Buy it. And also buy up the land over there where that big swamp is. Ellen, there's no way. We don't need a swamp. God has shown me that you need the swamp. Ellen, please. I know she had opposition, because my uncle was opposed to many of her ideas, especially about Loma Linda. Wish I'd have been alive back then. I don't think it would have been any different, would it? I'd have probably wondered if Ellen really knew what she was talking about too. After all, my uncle had a degree. He was an educated man. Ellen was a third grader. She was a woman. Did you catch that? The way I said that? Woman. She was just a woman. Interestingly, I'll give you a little sidelight, that swamp today is an artesian well that supplies almost the entire San Bernardino Valley. And you know what? It's not owned by Adventists. Adventists pay money to get the water from the swamp. Didn't know anything? She knew what God told her, and God knew that the water was there. You know, folks, when we originally started that great sanitarium, we believed in hydrotherapy. We believed in water therapy. And we were sitting on a gold mine that God had put there in the San Bernardino Valley. Oh, I get excited about this. Oh, Uncle Clarence, couldn't you have a little faith in Ellen? But she was a woman. And she only had a third grade education. And so it's gone and so it goes. And the last deception for Adventists will be to make of none effect the spirit of prophecy. Write her off as a woman that was hit in the head with a rock. We can't trust her. Beloved, I haven't found one thing she's ever written yet that I can't trust. She's right on, 100%. So Ellen writes these statements, letter 75, 1905. She again speaks of the common people and how God would finish His work. The Lord, she says, will use in the accomplishment of His work means that we do not now see. He will raise up from among the common people, men and women. I wonder if she ever felt that she was not very important just being a woman. I see these little comments that she puts in. God's going to raise up men and women. She plugged it in there. I think that's indicative of the way she was thinking. Brethren, she says, move aside. There's some room for women to work too. And she must have thrown around all 90 pounds. You know, she never weighed over 100 pounds in her life, I understand. Very small, petite woman. But she was a giant of a person. And she loved the brethren that she wrote those rebukes to. She loved them and she wept with them. She prayed with them to her dying day. So she says, God will raise up from among the common people, men and women, to do His work. Even as of old, He called the fishermen to be His disciples. Way back in 1885, Ellen wrote that some would try to control the work, however, and dictate how it should move forward. Can you believe this? Even under the angel that would lighten the earth with its glory, we'd have some people rising up against the idiotes, the common people, saying, you can't do that. You can't do that. Nobody gave you the right to do that. You don't have a degree to do that. But Ellen says this is what's going to happen. Whether they can do it or not, they're going to do it. That's what she said. And what are they going to do? I'm reading from Testimonies to Ministers, page 300. You can read it. God will use ways and means by which it will be seen that He is taking the reins in His own hands. The workers will be surprised by the simple means that He will use to bring about and perfect His work of righteousness. Do you suppose maybe you and I could be those simple means? Just simple instruments in the hands of God. Simple tools in His hands of the carpenter that He can use to finish the work. Another statement familiar to most of us comes from the book Great Controversy 606. Here we're told that the third angel's message will be given by the common people of the church. Listen, I quote, as the time comes for the third angel's message to be given with greatest power, the Lord will work through humble instruments, leading the minds of those who consecrate themselves to His service. God will lead our minds. The laborers will be qualified rather by the unction of His Spirit than by the training of literary institutions. Men of faith and prayer will be constrained to go forth with holy zeal, declaring the words which God gives them to speak. They won't be able to stay back. Why? Because they're men of faith and men of prayer, and nothing can stand in their way. May I suggest that we as a people have misunderstood our proper role as members of God's church? May I suggest that we too have also bought into Plato's philosophy, the Egyptian mindset, the Babylonian mindset, the fallen early church mindset, the great Roman mindset, and then apostate Protestants' mindset, we too have bought into that same mindset because we've misunderstood our role. Let me try and share with you what I mean through a simple survey that was made of 1,500 persons a few years ago. This questionnaire was given to church administrators, conference employees, church members, old and young, male and female. They were asked two basic questions. I don't think I brought those for the overhead today. Sorry I left those at home, but this is what they were. Number one, they were asked, 1,500 people, they were asked, question number one, define what you understand the laity to be. Now, if I was to ask you today, would you please define for me what the laity is? It wouldn't be fair to ask you because you're too intelligent. All right? But if I was to have asked you that first thing last night when you came in and handed you a sheet of paper, please define for me what is laity, and number two, would you describe the function of the laity within the church? I'm wondering if you would change your answer today as compared to what you would have written last night. Those were the two questions. Nearly 1,000 responses were returned, which was a tremendous return on 1,500 questionnaires that went out. Now let's look at the results. 85% of the 1,000 answered the questionnaire as to what a layperson was not. That isn't what they were asked. Please define what a layperson is. And they wrote back, 85% of them couldn't tell us what a layman was. They just wrote and told us what a layman wasn't. Boy, how ignorant laymen are. I'm just kidding, but listen to this. In other words, they said that a layman was not called to the ministry. He was not ordained. He was not employed by the church. He was not trained in theology. He was not an officer of the world church. 85% of those responding saw the layman as a person who really was not all that important to the church as a whole. We're just laymen. Just laymen. Man, I have heard that so many times. Just the layman. And this figure is sad. Flip the coin over. This is most revealing. 94% of the administrators who wrote the questionnaire were unwilling to have the laity help them in their work of administration. This was due to the concept that laity are not qualified to work in the areas of administration. Well, what if a man has his doctorate in administration? What if he has a degree in business administration? Not qualified to work in the church. Unless you're a clergy person. How did that mindset ever come? And so we have to have the pastor run the church. The pastor runs the committees. The pastor runs the boards. The pastor sits on the finances committee. What does he know about finance? I better watch it. I'm the stewardship director. And that isn't even his degree, is it? That's terrible. That's like having a man have a baby. That just doesn't fit. God made women for that purpose. They can handle some things we men can't. And so it is that many businessmen can handle things that we preachers can't. And we need to understand that. But because we bought into a system, we recognize that all of the higher sphere has to deal with that which is spiritual. Everything that deals with our schools, our churches, are all higher sphere things. Therefore, pastors always have to be in charge. You know, when I saw this, I said, I am glad I'm discovering some things. Pastors don't have to be in charge. They can let those who have the gifts in those areas be in charge, and they won't run away with the church because they love the same church. In fact, they'd probably do a better job because they're qualified to do that. But you see, there's still a little fear. A little fear. Jesus said, perfect love casteth out fear. Maybe it's because we haven't learned to love one another yet as God loved us. He trusts us with finishing the work once we get His Spirit. Folks, do we trust one another enough to let you do your job? 94% of them didn't trust the layman to help them with theirs. And 85% of the laymen felt they couldn't do it if they were asked. What a revelation this questionnaire was. This was due, this whole thing was due to the concept that laity are not qualified. Some other interesting points came out in the questionnaire. Almost everyone felt that it was the responsibility of the layman to assist the pastor in his ministry, rather than being trained by the pastor for their own ministry. Nearly every layman that responded to the questionnaire stated that they believed that the pastor should do his job of dealing with the spiritual things of the church while they did their job of common laboring in the office, workshop, home, factory, etc., so that they might be able to support the clergy with their finances. And I scratch my head and I say, haven't I heard that somewhere before? Yes. Where did this spiritual higher sphere come from? This mindset. It came from Egypt, a place that Ellen said we're retreating toward. Please come back. Take your Bibles, if you would please, and turn with me to Acts, changing our thoughts for a moment as we come into the last part of our study together. Let's take a look at some fun things here that hopefully will be a real encouragement to every one of you here, every one of us here today. Okay? Acts. You have the book of Acts, chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, and let's take a look at verse 41, if you would. Acts 2. Give me just a second here to find that. Acts chapter 2 and verse 41. Then they that gladly received his word were baptized. This is Peter preaching on the day of Pentecost. And that same day there were added unto them about how many people? 3,000 souls. And they continued steadfastly in the apostles' what? What does it say there? Doctrine and fellowship, and in the breaking of the bread in that fellowship, and also in one other thing. What was it? Prayers. There were three things that the 3,000 continued in, that they got involved in, that they supported. One of them was doctrine, very important. One was fellowship, and one was prayer. And the fear of all came upon these souls, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles, and all that believed were gathered together, and they were of one accord. They all had things in common, and they sold their possessions and their goods and parted them unto all men, and every man had, as man had need, they gave to one another. And they continued daily with one accord in the temple, breaking bread from house to house, ate their meat with gladness and singleness of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord added to the church daily as many as should be saved. Pick up kind of what was happening. Things were beginning to move, but they were based on three things: doctrine, fellowship, and prayer. And they united themselves together. Let's take a look at something. Those three areas we want to take a look at: doctrine, fellowship, and prayer. And we're going to tie all of this in as I come to this last part, believe it or not, into everything we've talked about this weekend so far. We're going to take a look at these three parts, but first I want to focus in on fellowship. The word fellowship comes from the words common and sharer. It meant to share something in common. Very specifically, it meant partnership. It meant two people shared equally as partners. Each Christian fellowship was a type of participation then between people where they shared equally that which they had in common, whether food, land, clothing, money, etc. Now, before you panic and leave, let me share with you a principle of stewardship. You'd expect something, I guess, from the stewardship director of the conference, wouldn't you? On stewardship before you left? So, I didn't hear that. We could only hope. Well, thank you, brother, for the invitation. Let me share a little principle. Equal giving does not equal equal sacrifice. Say it again. Equal giving does not equal equal sacrifice. That is the principle that the early church worked under. Let me give you a case in point. To bring it into our terminology today, there were men who had an income of $400 a month. There were others that may have had an income of $4,000 a month. They shared equally in sacrifice, but not in giving. Why? They couldn't. Because a man with a $400 income could never give $4,000, could he? I mean, it's an impossibility. But there's one thing they could both do, and that is they could both equally sacrifice. You see, there are some of us today that have bought into the worldly plan of giving and assessing people and making people feel guilty so they'll give more and so on. Our world is full of it. It's sponsored by greed. Okay? God's plan was never that way. He said, let me go into partnership with you. If you will return 10% of that which I give to you back to me, then it will indicate that you have bought into my partnership. That's your contribution. And I will then bless your 90% and see that it goes beyond what your 10% plus the 90% could have done if you'd have kept it yourself. And if you don't believe me, try me, he says. You'll find I'm a good partner. I never let you down. I may test you, but I'll never let you down. Now, he said, beyond the offering of the tithes, I want you to also return as I bless you. Because now you're going to be tested. And you'll find out that I'll bless you abundantly. And as I bless, I'm asking you to do one thing, and that is to return according to my blessing. It's up to you, whether you give much or little. No percentage. It's up to you to give as I've blessed. Now, some of those early church fathers back there, they were so thrilled with God's plan of systematic benevolence that they returned their 10%. That was no problem. And many of them returned offerings, and their offerings were sacrificial offerings. But you see, the rich and the poor sacrificed equally. What do I mean by the sacrifice? Let me give you a case in point of how we do it today, and it's not right. We have two men. Both of them make $4,000 a month. And the church comes along with the bright idea on how we can assess the saints, make them feel guilty, and give a little extra money. So we go on a 2% plan. Or 2 plus 4% plan. Or some other plan that man comes up with beyond what God asks. God said, 10% return to me, and whatever else, whether much or little, as I've blessed. That's God's rule. But man says, we've got to tap into this somehow. Everybody else is, so it wouldn't hurt us to get a little extra too. Nothing too good for the Lord's saints, we might think, to keep the system going. Folks, you can't play with the world and bring it into the church without destroying the church. Now, what happens when we have two fellows, both have $4,000 a month income, and now the church gives them a little tax? By the way, I have a whole series of studies on that, so I'm just giving you kind of a highlight, okay? So we give a little tax and say, well, we want you to give your offerings plus the tithe plus an additional 10%, 7%, 2%. I've seen all of those. What happens is that the one man who has $4,000 income happens to have a wife who's been sick for 6 months this last year. He has four kids. Two of them are in college. And two of the others have also been sick in and out of the hospital. His expenses are absolutely out of sight. And he drives two old cars. And they're constantly having problems. Some of you know what I'm talking about.